just want to get my recorder going before I start talking.
Okay, good afternoon, everybody. This is Bio 160, and it is November 25th. And we're going to start the digestive system today. And that's the most fun lecture of the whole class, because the digestive system is so disgusting. It's actually fun to talk about. Pictures, yeah, we got good pictures. Okay, but I want to talk about some procedural things first. Somebody asked about the final, and the final is scheduled for December 11th. I don't have that on the board, but I guess I can put it on the board real quick. Final, December 11th, and it's in this room, and it's at 1 p.m., just as usual. And I don't know what day the 11th is, but it's probably a Tuesday or a Thursday. Which day, do you know? You got to double check.
It's a Thursday.
It's a Thursday. So the 11th, that's the first week of finals week, because finals, I think, starts sort of in the middle of the week, and then it wraps around to the next week. I think this is in the first part of the wraparound, the 11th. All right, and that's not a cumulative test. It's only going to cover chapters 15, 17, and 19. All right, only three chapters. So it's not cumulative, just a regular old test. All right, but remember, in this class, you get to have counted for your grade 12 quizzes. But we've only taken 12 quizzes so far. And I say it like that is because in the syllabus it says you get to drop two, your two lowest scores. So those of you that want to take some additional quizzes, you're welcome to take quiz number 13 and 14. And I don't really have them clearly stated in the syllabus, so quiz 13 will be next time we meet on Tuesday, December 2nd. That's going to cover the digestive system. That's 15. And then a week from Tuesday, right, will be quiz number 14, and that's going to cover the urinary system. All right, so at the end of class, we'll give you an opportunity for those quizzes if you want to take them. You don't have to take them if you're comfortable with the scores that you have already on quizzes, right, because you get to drop two. Any questions on the dates or what's required to finish up the class? No? Okay. Good. All right, so let's move on to the digestive system. I forgot a marker. Where's our marker? Okay, I didn't have time to bring your quizzes down from last. Oh, you did take a quiz last time. You had a test last time. All right, but that is, you saw your results online. And I put that spreadsheet online so you can see exactly where you stand in the class and what you need to do for an A, B, C, or D. And if I had to give a grade today, what that grade would be. All right, and if you have some room to move up or down. Okay. If you have any questions about whether you're getting credit for a quiz that you took or a test, and if you have the right score, now is the time to see me during office hours to make sure that I have your right scores in the spreadsheet, because it's going to calculate your grade wrong if I don't. So now is the time to do it, not after the final or next semester when the grade is already given, right? So if you need to tell me of a correction, now is the time to do it, not after the semester is over, because then you need to go get the dean's signature, maybe the president's signature or something, and I don't know what else is required. It's a hassle, right? So, yeah, you might need the governor's signature too, right? So don't make a name for yourself. Correct it now, right? Of course, I try not to make any mistakes, but everybody can make a mistake. All right, so digestive system. Let's talk about that. Another name for, or the part of the digestive system that actually digests your food, is what we call the alimentary canal. It's a tube that's running through your body, but anything inside the alimentary canal is really outside your body, right? Because it's just a passageway through. It's not really inside your body until it gets absorbed from the alimentary canal or digestive tract and into your blood, right? And these are all the parts of the alimentary canal. You got the mouth, okay, don't kick the plug. You have the mouth, all right, what's the pharynx?
Throat.
That's your throat, okay, so we talked about that last time. And then, from the pharynx, where do you not want food to go?
Trachea.
Into the larynx, or trachea. What's the part of the larynx that prevents food normally from going into the trachea? It's that epiglottis, right? So under normal circumstances, food goes from the pharynx into the esophagus. That's the tube, carries it down to the stomach. After the stomach, goes into the small intestine, then large intestine, anal canal, and then out of your body. And then we have some accessory structures like salivary glands, the liver, the gallbladder, and pancreas we're going to talk about. All right, so you might wonder, well, gee whiz, if you're just going to be digesting things, why do you have all these different pieces and parts that make up the alimentary canal? And that's what we're going to talk about today. Why do you need all those parts and pieces in there? But you should also be familiar with where you find all these parts and pieces. Well, here's the oral cavity. Posterior to the oral cavity is the pharynx. Right? Then food goes into the esophagus. This is a nice long tube from the mouth down into the stomach, which is right here. And then from the stomach, it goes into the small intestine. That's all these convoluted tubes right here. And finally empties into the large intestine, which is here, here, and here. Right? And then through the rectum and out the anus. That's part of all parts of the digestive tract. And the accessory structures are salivary glands. So you have in the oral cavity, the pancreas, which is in the abdominal cavity, close to the liver. Okay, and the gallbladder is kind of associated with the liver. It's not really part of the liver, but it receives secretions from the liver. So it's associated, in a sense, with the liver. Yeah. If the gallbladder is, we're going to look at the duct system, right? But if that gallbladder is removed, then you can't get stones in this area because it's gone. But you do have tubes still that connect your liver to your intestine, and I suppose those could get blocked. A stone can't develop and enlarge. It will get passed through, but there still possibly could be a blockage. Just like there could be, when we look at the urinary system, there's going to be a tube that goes from a kidney, which is about up over here, down to the urinary bladder, which is about in this location. There can be kidney stones that get lodged in that tube, which is what we call a ureter, right? And that's, yeah, it's miserable. It makes people miserable when that happens. I've known people to have many babies and one kidney stone, and they'd say they'd rather have 10 babies than one kidney stone. Okay, that's how bad a kidney stone hurts. So probably gallbladder is similar, too. If you have a stone in the gallbladder, it's probably very similar in the sensation of that pain compared to a kidney stone. Okay. All right, well, we're always interested in layers that make things up, like the layers of a blood vessel. Let's look at the layers of the alimentary canal. Okay, so here are some layers that make up the alimentary canal. Lining the inside of the tube is the mucosa. That's the surface epithelium. It has glands for secretion, and it also has cells for absorption of digested materials. The next deepest one is the submucosa. That's a layer underneath the mucosa. It contains blood vessels and lymphatic vessels and glands, and it even has some nerves because the digestive tract is very motile. It's moving around all the time. And what is an organ need to have in order for it to move around? What's the kind of tissue that's specialized for contraction? Muscle. So, the next layer is the muscularis layer, the muscle layer, for moving things through the digestive system, and there are nerves that control that. There are two kinds of smooth muscles. There's a longitudinal and a circular kind of muscle. We're going to look at those. And then the outer covering of the digestive tract is what we call the serosa. It's a membrane made of connective tissue that surrounds all the digestive tracts. And that's kind of a slippery substance. It's lubricated because your intestines are moving around inside your body all the time. So what do these layers kind of look like? So here is a section of probably small intestine. And on the outside, you have the serosa. And the serosa holds the intestines in place via another membrane, which we call the mesentery. So mesentery comes up to the intestine, surrounds it, and also within the mesentery there are blood vessels. that are there for absorption, but that also nourishes the digestive tract. So there is the serosa. All right, what's the next deepest layer? On the outside is the serosa. The next deepest is the, in your notes, what's in your notes? What's the next deepest layer in your notes? Yeah, the muscularis, or muscle layer. All right, so here I see the muscle layer here and here. So the most superficial one is a longitudinal. That means it's these muscle fibers are lined along the long axis of the digestive tract. So these are long. So when they contract, what happens to the intestines? Do they shrink down this way? Do they shrink down in diameter, or do they shrink down in length? They shrink down in length due to these longitudinals. The next deepest layer are these circular smooth muscles. So when they contract, how does the shape of the intestine change? Does it get shorter in length, or smaller in diameter? Smaller in diameter. So there's two ways that the intestine can change its shape, in length and also in diameter, due to these two different kinds of arrangements in smooth muscle cells. All right, the next layer right here is the submucosa. Okay, and we have glands in the submucosa. It's hard to see on this diagram, so let's zoom in to this region right here. All right, so here is the serosa, here's the muscularis layer. This is the circular and longitudinal. And then deep to that is the submucosa. And we see some nerve fibers in there. We got blood vessels and glands. And we even have some nerves in this layer too. Okay? And these nerve networks that you have in the intestines, we call that a plexus, a mesenteric or myenteric plexus in the intestines, submucosa. All right, and then lining the surface, the interior surface of the digestive tract, that's what we call the mucosa right there. This structure that looks like a finger sticking up, that's a villus. All of them together are what we call villi. These things you can't quite see with your naked eye, but you can get sort of an impression, because if we were to look at the lining of the intestine, it would look like a velvet material. So you can't necessarily see each of those fibers on a velvet material, but if you look really close, probably you could tell. All right, so that's about the size of these villi right here. Not quite microscopic, but almost. And on the inside of each villus, you have a capillary network poking up into the villus. So what's special about a capillary? Yeah, exchange can take place. So things can be absorbed from your digestive tract into this circulatory system via this capillary. But things that can be absorbed via this capillary are sugars and proteins, but not fats, not lipids. What part? Where do lipids get absorbed? I think I was on your test maybe last time. Yeah, part of the lymphatic system, namely a lacteal, and in the very center part of this villus right here is a lacteal for absorbing lipids after they've been digested. Okay, and then also you have lymphoid nodules in your intestine to help fight infection so that bacteria that are in your intestine don't gain access to your body. Okay, so those are the layers, the serosa, the muscularis layer, the submucosa, and then the mucosa itself. All right, well, let's take just another overview of your digestive tract. And this is it right here. I can almost get all of it. Starting with your mouth, you have your tongue, esophagus, stomach, and then you have this big long tube right here that curves around inside your abdominal cavity. That's the small intestine. And notice that that's about 6 meters long. How is it that something that's 6 meters long can fit inside your abdominal cavity? What do we do to it? Fold it up. Yeah, you kind of coil it up, fold it up, and it fits inside your abdominal cavity. And then material is passed on to the large intestine right here. Now, does the large intestine look different than the small intestine? Absolutely, you can tell. All right. So we're going to see what the function of the large intestine is compared to the small, because it has a different characteristic, a different shape and size. Chances are it has a much different kind of function, and indeed it does. All right. This part is what we call the cecum, and hanging off the cecum is a part of the large intestine that in people we don't use for digestion anymore, but other animals do. Okay, for instance, like ruminants or other animals that eat a lot of vegetable type material, plant material. Okay, this is enlarged and it's important for digestion of cellulose. But in us, it's just a lymphatic organ. That's what we call the appendix. Okay, so it's not important for any of the digestive processes, but it's important for your immune system. All right, so notice how long these tubes are. Okay. Okay, let's go back and look at this section right here. And let's just say that this section is really just part of the small intestine. Okay, just part of the small intestine. And let's look at some anatomy of the small intestine right here. Notice if we look on the inside that it is not just a smooth tube. Look inside. What do we see inside this tube right here? It's kind of a rough ribbed surface, all right? And so what does that really mean? That means that the small intestine in its length has folds or ridges in it. So actually, the small intestine is a lot longer than 6 meters, right? So it's 6 meters when it's all what? Folded up, and those folds that make the small intestine a little bit shorter are what we call circular folds. Right, so if we really wanted to measure what the real length of the small intestine is, we should actually flatten all of those circular folds out so that it looked more like a garden hose. Right? Okay. And that's an important concept because you have to absorb things from your digestive tract into your blood by the surface area that that particular tube has. Okay. So when I say surface area, what comes to mind? What is the everyday object that you should think of when I say surface area? Surface area. Like the surface area of the lungs. What was the surface area of the lungs? It was half of a tennis court. Yeah, I forget what it was. 70 square meters. Okay. And the reason why that huge surface area is inside your lungs is because the alveoli are all what? All folded up and packed inside your lungs. All right. But what did we say surface area really was? What's an everyday object that you use all the time for you to think of surface area? I don't know if everybody was in class, but remember I went over, I grabbed that ruler. What did I do with that ruler? I measured, what is that thing called?
Doorway.
That's right. So surface area, when I say surface area, you should just think of doorway for what kind of function? A doorway for, what do you use a doorway for? To enter a room or leave a room, right? So a doorway is just a surface area for exchange, all right? So when we fold the small intestine like that, that increases the surface area, that increases the size of the doorway for what? Absorption of nutrients that we eat. So that's the first thing that increases the surface area of the small intestine. Number one, circular folds. But do you see anything else that has folds in it, or convolutions, besides the circular folds? If we look just in this one little area right here, what does this structure look like in the mucosa? Look at this. Here's a fold, here's one here, here's one here, here's another one here. So what do we call these projections, these finger-like projections coming up? These are not quite cilia. Cilia are even hard to see underneath a microscope. So they're microscopic or even smaller. These we can almost see with our naked eye. These are what we call villi. So villi increase the surface area again because they are really what? Folds. Okay, so these are villi right here. That's the second thing that increases the surface area for absorption in the small intestine. And if we zoom into the tip of this villus right here, we see all these nice columnar cells, and oh, I look, it almost looks like there's a goblet cell right here secreting mucus, and that mucus helps protect these cells. But let's look at these cells right on the apex of this villus. So here we have some cells, nice columnar cells, and what's on the top of these columnar cells? This is where you find the microvilli. So that's how small these microvilli are. You couldn't see them on a villus, but with a good microscope, you can see them on top of these cells. But what do these villi do? Microvilli. They're not there for motility. They're not like cilia that sweep. They are just what? Folds in the plasma membrane, again, which increases the surface area for absorption of this one particular cell right here. So the microvilli, I'm going to put a 3 right there. That's the third structure that increases the surface area for absorption of the intestinal tract. So a good way to think about that is when the small intestine is just kind of laid out on a table and you measure it, it's about 6 meters long. But what's the real length in terms of, all right, if we were to flatten all of these microvilli out, we could take the top of that cell and stretch it so that it was flat instead of having microvilli on there. Okay, then we could measure the surface area. But what else would we have to flatten out to measure the surface area? We'd have to flatten out the villi as well, right? So first we can straighten out all of these microvilli and all these thousands of cells, and then flatten out all of these thousands of villi to get it flat. But what else would we have to flatten out to get the small intestine really flat? Is the circular folds as well. So now think of how long that tube would be. It would be really long when you flatten out all those things, because that enhances the surface area. And if we were to do that with the small intestine, it would be 186 square meters. So what is the size of the lungs? We said was 70. This is over 100 square meters more, right? So that's almost three times as much. So the surface area for exchange in the small intestine is like 1.5 tennis courts. That's a huge surface area. So that's why when you eat something, you absorb those materials, because there's a huge doorway for exchange. Okay, so what increases the size of that doorway for exchange in the small intestine? You would say, oh, well, there's three things. There is circular folds. The next smallest thing would be the villi. And then the next smaller thing would be the microvilli. So that's why you're able to absorb those nutrients and stay alive. Okay, important structure. All right, so let's go to the stomach. Let's see what the stomach kind of looks like. All right, I'm not going to talk about teeth and all that kind of stuff, but you know what? That's real important for probably to know something about the different kinds of teeth. Sometimes you're interested in a particular tooth, and sometimes I've had trouble trying to find what the names of some of these teeth are. And, oh, even on this diagram, look, they're not labeled. So it is difficult sometimes. But these are molars in the back. These are incisors up over here. But I'm not going to test you on teeth. But that's a great profession to become involved in, anything in dentistry. All right, but we're going to press on to the stomach. All right, so how do things get to the stomach? Well, you use your teeth, right, to chew stuff up, and you use the salivary glands to lubricate that bolus of food. There is an enzyme in saliva that does a little initial digestion of starches, breaks it down into glucose. And since it's lubricated because of saliva, and that epiglottis, let's pretend, is going to work, that bolus of food goes into the esophagus. And right at about this point right over here, then your autonomic nervous system takes over and pushes it down into the stomach, right, which is about where we are. So how does something get pushed into the stomach? Because of something we call peristalsis, right? It forms this little pinch in the esophagus, and that pinch follows down all the way into the stomach, and that is just due to the contraction of the circular muscles that form this little pinch, and then it successively moves down the esophagus, moving this bolus of food down into the stomach. And indeed, you could think of how that's how everything moves through your entire digestive system. Okay, by alternate contractions of circular muscles and longitudinal muscles that move this bolus of food, and that motion, that constriction, contraction of smooth muscle is what we call peristalsis. That contraction, moving material through the digestive system is peristalsis. That's probably a good term to know. All right, so what is the function of the stomach? Okay, it is important for storing and mixing. That's the most important function of the stomach. It has a couple other kinds of functions, which we're going to talk about. Now notice, do you see anything about digestion right here? And absorption of nutrients. No. The stomach really doesn't have that particular kind of function. It's pretty much for storing and mixing. And the stuff that gets into your stomach, it's mixed with some digestive enzymes and some acid, hydrochloric acid. And that's what we call gastric juice. Gastric juice mixes with the food that we eat, and that becomes chyme, right? Very acidic mixture. So the secretions from the stomach, namely pepsin. Pepsin comes from a cell that's in the mucosa that we call a chief cell. And pepsin does an initial digestion of proteins, but not a complete digestion. So this is only a cursory, incomplete digestion of proteins. And so I don't mention it as being an important function of the stomach. Right? The important two are storing and mixing. And in order for pepsin to work, it has to be in a very acidic environment, like maybe pH 1 or 2. And that's what this hydrochloric acid is for. And hydrochloric acid comes from different kinds of cells, which we call parietal cells. And the other kind of material that is secreted in as gastric juice is what we call intrinsic factor. Intrinsic factor is necessary for the absorption of vitamin B12 in your body. And that intrinsic factor also comes from parietal cells. Now, who can tell me what vitamin B12? Vitamin B12. That's called cobalamin, and that's necessary for red blood cell production. Okay? So somebody will become anemic if the stomach isn't functioning properly, or in that secreting this intrinsic factor for vitamin B12. Okay, so storing and mixing. So let's take a look at the stomach. Here's a nice overview of the stomach someplace, right here. This might be an exam figure. Is that an exam figure? I think so. Okay, so the esophagus is coming down from the oral cavity. It enters the stomach right in this region right here, which is what we call the cardiac sphincter. So a sphincter is a circular, smooth muscle that contracts, and it acts like a valve. You learn the names of a couple circular skeletal muscles. What's the name of a circular skeletal muscle that you learned? Skeletal muscle is one that you control voluntarily. Oh, maybe we didn't learn it in here. The orbicularis oculi around your eyes, that's your winking muscle. And also the one around your lips right here, the orbicularis oris. But a sphincter is a circular smooth muscle, but it is controlled autonomically in your body. So it's made out of smooth muscle, not skeletal muscle. And when the cardiac sphincter isn't working properly, that allows for the acidic contents of the stomach, which we call chyme, to reflux back up into the esophagus. Right? We call that gastroesophageal reflux. And if that's causing a problem, it's a disease. They call that GERD. Okay, and that causes heartburn, and that feels kind of like a heart attack. That's one of the reasons why we call this the cardiac sphincter right here. And some people can't even hardly sleep at night sometimes because this cardiac sphincter is so weak, they get a lot of reflux, and it produces a really nasty burning sensation, okay, in their chest. So a lot of people have to sleep on an incline to keep food in their stomach instead of going back up into their esophagus. All right, so the stomach kind of looks a little strange. You can see that it has a lot of folds as well. Now, these folds are not there because of absorption, because the stomach hardly absorbs anything whatsoever. All right, these folds are there because when you eat something, guess what happens to the stomach? It gets bigger. It expands. All right, and if you eat a lot, it expands a whole lot more. All right, and if you eat a whole lot, it can expand a tremendous amount without perforating, without ripping. Okay, so here you see the stomach, and I've heard of reports of people eating so much that the stomach actually stretches all the way down to the urinary bladder. That's incredible. Don't do that Thursday. So we're all going to try. Okay, it's an interesting time of year. But that stomach is there to just hold food until the small intestine is ready to work on it. Okay, so we'll talk about the function of the small intestine in just a little bit. All right, so those folds, what are those folds called? Rugae. That's for expansion of the stomach right here. Okay, so this region right here, this is where a bunch of gas can develop, and it is just held okay, until it's absorbed, or I suppose you burp or something, but eventually it will be absorbed and passed through the digestive tract. This is the beginning of the small intestine down over here, so this is no longer large intestine. And the first part, or proximal part of the small intestine, is the duodenum. And there's another gate between the small intestine and large intestine. It's a sphincter. We call it the pyloric sphincter. And it's the job of this pyloric sphincter to control the emptying of the stomach. And what controls the emptying of the stomach is just the amount of work that the small intestine is doing. So here you have the pyloric sphincter. Here's the pyloric canal. This is the pylorous region of the stomach. So the stomach has three main regions, the fundic part, the body, which is this right here, and the pyloric region. All right, so this is a good place to start. And the cardiac region, but up by the cardiac sphincter. Okay, so make sure you can label the stomach on that next exam. Okay, so again, the functions of the stomach, storage and mixing, not much digestion, and actually no absorption of nutrients whatsoever. All right, so that takes us to the small intestine. The function of the small intestine. All right, I don't have it on here. But I'm sure I do someplace right here. That's the most important part of the alimentary canal for digestion as well as absorption of material. The small intestine has got three divisions. The part that's attached to the stomach is the duodenum. The part that's attached to the large intestine is the ileum. And the part that's in between is what we call the jejunum. So let's see if I can find some parts of these things. Little bit. Okay, so here is the pyloric sphincter. So here's the stomach up over in this region. Material moves into the small intestine. And again, you can see all these circular folds. Right? And now the digestive tract of the small intestine can't operate at the pH that the stomach is operating at. What did we say? What was the pH of the stomach? Yeah, like 1 or 2, very acidic. Okay, but that material, if it comes down into the small intestine, that's going to erode away the small intestine because it's so acidic. So how would you neutralize an acid? With a base. That's right. So the pancreas is going to secrete a base into the small intestine, neutralizing that acid, and as a matter of fact, it's going to secrete even excess base. So now that the pH of the small intestine is actually a little basic, and that's going to aid in the digestion of materials in the small intestine. All right, and the small intestine is the largest part because this is where all the digestion takes place, as well as absorption of the digested materials. So everything that you eat has to be processed by the small intestine. And the small intestine has to digest it completely and absorb all the nutrients. Okay. So I don't have a picture of the different divisions of the small intestine. Okay, except for this diagram right here. The part that's connected to the stomach is the duodenum. Okay, this part in the middle is the jejunum, and then the last part that empties into the large intestine is what we call the ileum. All right, so don't forget, small intestine has got these three parts to it. And that's just a huge surface area for absorption of nutrients. Okay. So why is it that the small intestine can digest things? Well, that's because the pancreas is secreting fluid that neutralizes the acid from the stomach, but the pancreas is also secreting digestive enzymes into the small intestine. There are proteases that digest proteins. There are lipases that digest. Who can tell me what a lipase digests? Yeah, lipids like fats. Okay, and then there's an enzyme that breaks down sugar molecules, complex sugar molecules, and we call that amylase. So all of those secretions are placed into the small intestine. and it's just going to be absorbing nutrients. Okay, so we saw there are secretions placed into the stomach. There are lots of secretions placed into the small intestine. And that's always going to be in a water solution. All right, so your body is losing a lot of water into the stomach and into the small intestine for the purpose of digestion. Right, don't forget this fluid inside the intestine is really not inside your body. It's outside your body in this tube right over here. So if you were to lose all of that fluid, guess what would happen to you? You would dehydrate as a result, right? Because that water is no longer inside your body. Right? And that's what the function of the large intestine is right here. Where did that go? Right here. Okay, the large intestine starts at the cecum, and I'll show you this. I got a good picture of the large intestine. So the large intestine is not responsible for any digestion. All the digestion takes place in what part of the alimentary canal? The small intestine. So everything that should be digested is digested in the small intestine if everything goes correctly. But remember, there were a lot of secretions placed into the stomach and the small intestine. And the job of the large intestine is to resorb all of that water so that you don't become dehydrated. So the large intestine has an important absorption function, but it's not for nutrients, it's for water and some salts. So the remnants of that digested material, okay, the water is sucked out of it. That's another way of saying fecal formation. So the large intestine is important for fecal formation, right? Taking a watery, soupy material and just making feces out of it. All right, also in the small intestine, some vitamins are produced. Vitamin K, B12, thiamine, riboflavin. But these are not produced by the processes that your body controls. They're produced by bacteria that live in the large intestine. So these are symbiotic organisms, right, that live in the large intestine that are producing these essential nutrients for you. So in order for you to have normal physiology, to have these vitamins right here, then, of course, you need to have those normal bacteria living in your intestines. Okay, so what's vitamin K? Anybody remember what vitamin K is important for? Blood clotting, okay, coagulation. Vitamin B12 for red blood cell production, and all of these are for thiamine and riboflavin. These are important for all kinds of metabolism inside the body. Okay, and so what do these bacteria use as an energy source in order to help produce these vitamins for us? Because we said that the small intestine absorbs all the natural nutrients from the food that we eat. What do the bacteria, what do they use? I'm covering it up. What kind of food do they use? Cellulose. Okay, so cellulose is just basically wood fiber. It's a material that we can't digest. It's bulk that we have in our diet, like the cell walls of all the plant material that we eat is made up of cellulose. The wood that makes wood out of a tree, that is cellulose. So you could eat a tree all day long, but it's not going to do you any good. But cellulose, for some organisms, is a very important energy source, namely bacteria, because the compound that makes cellulose is the same thing that makes glycogen, and the building block of glycogen is glucose. So cellulose that wood is made out of is basically just made up of sugar molecules, but put together in a certain way that when you put water on it, it doesn't dissolve. It's insoluble. It's insoluble bulk, which is really important for trees. Why is that really important for trees? That they have sugar molecules, but they put the sugar molecules in a certain way so they don't dissolve. Why is that important for a tree? Yeah, exactly right. Like today, if it was a soluble kind of sugar, as soon as it rained, the tree would melt away, would dissolve away. But cellulose is such that it doesn't dissolve in water. But certain bacteria can break cellulose down, and it's like, for us, eating a sugar cube. Okay, they can digest cellulose and convert it basically right into sugar. So what kind of organism do you know can chew on wood and live just fine? Like termites. That's right. They chew on wood. There's bacteria in the intestine of termites. that can digest cellulose into glucose, and then those bacteria share that glucose with the termites, and there goes your house, unfortunately. Okay. Well, that has some important implications. All right, so let's kind of review what the stomach does, what the parts of the intestine do again. Like the stomach, what's the function of the stomach? Storage and mixing. The function of the small intestine is digestion and absorption. And absorption of nutrients, right? And the large intestine is absorption of what? What about nutrients? Nope, that's up over here. Okay, so the small intestine is important for absorption of water and salt. Well, what happens if the intestine isn't doing its job? It hasn't absorbed all the nutrients, and some nutrients, like sugars or lipids or maybe even proteins, move from the small intestine into the large intestine. What's going to happen there? Anything noteworthy? Well, who's in the large intestine that's going to thank you for all those nutrients? You've got all those billions of bacteria, and now you start to feed them, maybe glucose or lipids or something. What are they going to do? Well, it's just a big party for them. Yeah. Okay, they go, well, thanks for all that energy. I'm going to proliferate. I'm going to divide, and I'm going to produce a lot of methane, a lot of gas, and that's going to be irritable to the large intestine. That's going to increase the motility, the contraction of the large intestine. All right, and so what's going to happen? That's going to produce diarrhea, all right, because now that material is moving too fast through the large intestine to absorb water, all right, so what's clinically, what's very dangerous about diarrhea? Because now dehydration, right, and also salt imbalance. You're not absorbing salt and water, so you can dehydrate. You'll have electrolyte imbalance. And as a matter of fact, probably more people in the world die of diarrhea than any other kind of malady, all right? Not so much in the United States, okay, but in other parts of the world, what's a really most common reason why people get diarrhea? Eating contaminated food or contaminated water, right? So if you could figure out how to supply the world's population with clean drinking water, you could probably save more lives than anybody else in history. Just amazing. Just a real simple thing like that. All right, now what kind of person is most susceptible to diarrhea? Yeah, newborns, right? Little kids, neonates, which is even sadder, okay? So, but that really kind of underscores the importance of this large intestine in fecal formation, absorbing water, and protecting your health. So what kind of processes, for instance, so we call that malabsorption syndrome. When the large intestine isn't working, absorbing water, malabsorption syndrome, producing copious amounts of watery diarrhea, okay, that's malabsorption syndrome. That might happen in us because there's a time in our life where we can't digest a certain kind of sugar. And I know somebody in here probably has that condition. Okay, for instance, you might eat some kind of dairy product, okay, and there is a sugar called lactose that goes through the small intestine, and the enzyme that digests lactose is called lactase, right, so a lot of times we name the enzyme after the substrate it works on. Lactose is the sugar, lactase, A-S-E, is the enzyme, is no longer being produced by the pancreas here, so lactose doesn't get broken down, so the small intestine can't absorb it. Where does that lactose go? Right into the large intestine, and what do those bacteria do? Yeah, they start to party down, right? That produces irritability, all right, a lot of gas, and then you start to stop absorbing water from the large intestine, and you end up with some really nasty diarrhea as a result of that until you pass that material through. So that's the malabsorption syndrome. And believe it or not, some people actually do that, okay, consciously, because there's a drug that came to market, maybe 10 years ago or so, and it was a dietary aid, okay, because a lot of people have trouble controlling their weight, we get too heavy, and the food that provides most of the energy that makes us bulk up is not carbohydrate, not protein, but lipids in particular. There's a lot of energy content in lipids. Right, and as a matter of fact, In the Western diet, lipids are something that we seek. It has the flavor of food that we like a lot. So, but you can't eat a lot of it because you'll gain a lot of weight. Well, somebody figured out how to design a drug to block the absorption of fat. Where does fat get absorbed from? The small intestine. And as a matter of fact, what part of the small intestine? How does it get absorbed into your capillaries or where? And via lacteals in the small intestine. So somebody figured out a drug to block the absorption of fat. Now that sounds like a great idea, right? Because then you could eat like bacon and ice cream all day long and not gain very much weight because you're just going to be passing that fat through your stools, right? You're not going to be absorbing it. But let's consider that a little bit further. So the lipids aren't being absorbed by your small intestine. Where do they go? Large intestine. Who's in your large intestine? Yeah, those partying bacteria again, and they see all those lipids, and what do? They go, wahoo, look at all of this energy. Producing what? Gas, watery diarrhea, but that's not all, not just watery diarrhea, but watery, oily diarrhea, because you're not absorbing that lipid anymore. And it's so much that a person has no idea when they're stooling themselves at all. Their small intestine is just so irritated. Okay, you have no idea when you're stooling yourself, so what would you have to do? I mean, you could be driving down the freeway, giving a lecture. Okay, what would you have to do if you're on that medication? Yeah, you have to wear a diaper, right? Because you just have no control over your bowels when that happens. All right, does anybody know the name of that drug? It's called Xenical. What did you call it? Oh, Lipodrim, maybe, yeah, I'm not familiar with that. That might be a different kind of trade name, okay. All right, so there were some serious side effects like there are to all medications. So people gave up on Xenical a couple years ago, but then they reintroduced it. And so I think they cut the dose in half or a third or maybe even 75%. So now you only take a little bit of it. And does anybody know what that drug is called? That's called Li, okay, that blocks absorption of lipids from the small intestine. Okay, so it's just interesting to know of the counteractions that take place in the body and how it produces malabsorption syndrome. Okay, well, there's a lot of vitamins that we absorb from our small intestine that are lipid soluble. Okay, so that means that in order to get those vitamins inside our body, the small intestine has to be able to absorb lipids. Right, if they can't absorb lipids, then you can't absorb those vitamins and you'll be deficient of whatever those vitamins are. So if you take these drugs that block the absorption of fat, what else are you not absorbing besides the fat? All those important nutrients that you might need in minute quantity. So there might be some other serious side effects too that you have to face when you take like Li or Xenical or other kinds of lipid absorbing drugs. The other thing that you should be kind of aware of is you might take other medications. And if you read the label, it says, well, one of the side effects of this medication is malabsorption syndrome. And malabsorption syndrome is what? Watery diarrhea. What causes watery diarrhea? The inability of the small intestine to absorb nutrients that are normally absorbed. So that medication is blocking the absorption of some nutrient, maybe glucose or some other nutrient that gets passed into the large intestine, causing that irritability. All right, so if you read on the label malabsorption syndrome, you see that drug has another effect in the body, blocking absorption, for instance. Yeah. Yeah, some kind of synthetic oil. Okay, Olestra. Olestra was it. I find it kind of fascinating. I guess it's palatable to do that. And I would say if you like potato chips a lot, that's probably great. Okay, there's another burden in potato chips, and that's sodium, right? They're just loaded with salt, so that's not good for you either. But so if you were to eat only Olestra, there might be some other consequences. I don't know if vitamins get absorbed in Olestra or not. I don't know if you absorb essential nutrients if you have Olestra in your diet. I'm not sure. But I've never heard of like Olestra ice cream or Olestra bacon. But if they came up with something like that, I'd be interested to find out. Okay. So that's the important job of the large intestine. And that's why, okay, let me put this back up. That's why you have the stomach, okay? Because in order for the small intestine to do its job, food or chyme can't move through the small intestine too fast. If it moves too fast before it's processed and it gets into the large intestine, that produces malabsorption syndrome. So the small intestine has to work on chyme for a sufficient period of time. But if you eat a lot, guess what's going to happen? If you didn't have a stomach, that would push the contents through the small intestine before it became processed. That would produce malabsorption syndrome. So the stomach holds on to the material that can't be processed by the small intestine until the small intestine is ready to process it. And that's why the stomach gets bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger when you're feasting. Okay, that's why it expands. And so that's why we say storage. All right, it's waiting for the small intestine to do its job. And when it's done with its job, it tells the stomach, okay, I'm ready for more. And then the stomach gives it a little bit more and then shuts down. So how does your intestine know how to do all this kind of stuff? Okay. A couple different things. There are autonomic nervous system that helps control the digestive system. There are local reflexes within the intestinal tract. And then there are hormones that help control our digestive tract. So all kinds of different things. So we looked at the central nervous system. What are the two main parts of the central nervous system? Two main parts of the central, you said, well, I thought we were talking about digestive system. No, let's go back to the brain for a second. What are the two parts of the central nervous system? It's the brain, yeah, and the spinal cord. So do you think you have a lot of nerve cells or a lot of neurons in your spinal cord? Yeah, a lot, right? I mean, it's just loaded. Guess what? There are more neurons in your digestive tract than there are in your spinal cord, right? Many, many more. As a matter of fact, for years and years and years, people thought that the nervous system in your gastrointestinal tract was even much more important than your brain or spinal cord, because it's just so loaded with nerves controlling what? How things move around inside your digestive tract. So we call that the myenteric plexus. Myenteric plexus. Okay. All right, so autonomic nervous system, you got what, the two divisions? You got parasympathetic and sympathetic parts of the autonomic nervous system. The parasympathetic nervous system is stimulatory on your digestive tract. It's inhibitory on your heart, but it's stimulatory on your digestive tract. So how does the parasympathetic nervous system know that you have material in your digestive tract? Well, when you eat something, it goes to the stomach and it stretches the stomach. And you have nerve fibers in your stomach that can sense that stretch. All right, so then they send signals to the medulla. Where's the medulla oblongata at? Brainstem. Yeah, it's the back of your neck right there. Well, it's in your head, but in the back of your head. The medulla oblongata then sends a signal back down to the stomach, and these signals increase gastric juice secretion and increase contraction, right, for mixing the gastric juice with the food that you just ate. So that increases motility as a result of stretch. So that's one of the first things. All right. Sympathetic nervous system, on the other hand, is inhibitory, has the opposite effect, right? It's antagonistic control. So for instance, when you start to exercise, right, that's going to send impulses from the medulla down to the stomach that's going to decrease gastric secretions and decrease motility for mixing. And that's just going to hold that material for later after exercise. Okay. So that's the first thing, autonomic nervous system. And then you have some local reflexes too. Local just means that it doesn't have to involve the brain. There are things that just happen inside the intestines as a result. So when you eat something that stretches the stomach, again, there are receptors in the stomach that send action potentials via the intramural plexus. Intramural just means the plexus within the intestines themselves, or the myenteric plexus would be another way. So all the nerves become stimulated. These nerves are in the intestines themselves. And when they become stimulated, that increases secretion and increases contraction. So just by stretching the intestines, that increases activity of the intestines. So we call that a local reflex, because all of this electrical activity doesn't have to go anywhere. It doesn't have to go to the spinal cord or the brain to happen. They just stimulate each other inside the digestive tract. Okay. The third thing are hormones. And I'm going to talk about two hormones. Gastrin comes from the stomach. So whenever things enter the stomach, that expands or stretches the stomach. We call that distension. And that causes the release of gastrin. And gastrin goes into the blood, and it's carried everywhere in the body, including back to the stomach. And gastrin increases gastric secretions and peristalsis. So when you have a lot of stuff in the stomach, it becomes more active. All right, so then there is an antagonistic mechanism to help control things in the stomach. And this is due to a hormone we call secretin. And this comes from the small intestine. So when the stomach pushes digesting material from the stomach into the small intestine, guess what happens to the small intestine? It stretches too, right? It distends. And as a result of that, the small intestine releases secretin into the blood. Secretin then goes everywhere in the body, including the stomach. The effect on the stomach is that it decreases secretions and peristalsis. So the stomach becomes quiet. Right, so when does the small intestine secrete secretin? When it is busy doing stuff, right? When it's busy secreting, when it's busy digesting. And at that time, when the small intestine is busy, what should the stomach be doing? Should it be pumping a lot of stuff into the small intestine? Or should it be kicking back, waiting for the small intestine to do its job? It should be waiting, right? And so that's what the function of secretin is. It tells the stomach to hold on, slow down, I'm busy, okay, just wait until I'm done doing my job. The other thing that secretin does is that it causes, it stimulates the pancreas to secrete digestive enzymes into the small intestine, as well as that neutralizing fluid to neutralize the acids. We call that bicarbonate. And it tells the liver to increase secretions into the small intestine as well. Okay. So what would happen if the small intestine wouldn't release secretin properly? Well, the stomach wouldn't know when to push material into the small intestine. The small intestine would get overloaded. It'd probably start dumping stuff into the large intestine, produce malabsorption syndrome. Things would be a mess, right? So when I think of secretin, I always think of that skit that was on the I Love Lucy show. Who's the actress in I Love Lucy? Who is Lucy? Yeah, Lucille Ball. And her friend, who is her friend? Oh, yeah, Ethel. Remember they went to work one time? And they didn't have many jobs, but they were at work one time, and they were supposed to take candies that were on a conveyor belt, right, coming out of the candy machine. All right, so they take a candy and wrap it up and put it in the container. And so they started out just fine, and then what happened? The conveyor belt sped up, so then they had to work really fast. And then the conveyor belt got even faster, right? And so then what do? They start putting the candy in their pockets. They couldn't wrap it, and they put it in their mouth. Their cheeks were poking out, okay? So I always think of the regulation of the stomach and the small intestine regulated by secretin is kind of like that skit, right? So if the stomach is not being regulated, it's doing what? That's like the conveyor belt speeding up, right, and causing problems for the small intestine. So things have to work together with the proper timing, and secretin, right, controls the proper timing of this motility between the stomach and the small intestine. Okay. So secretin causes secretions from the pancreas because the pancreas secretes bicarbonate that neutralizes the acids from the stomach. It secretes trypsin, which is a protease that digests proteins. Trypsin digests proteins. Amylase digests starch. It digests starch. And starch is, does anybody know what the basic building block of starch is? Sugar. It's glucose. So it's glucose bound to another glucose, bound to another one. Okay. Starch is just a soluble form of this compound. So it's very similar to cellulose, but cellulose, remember, doesn't dissolve. And then lipase digests lipids. Okay, so the pancreas secretes these materials into a duct, and we call that the pancreatic duct. And that empties into the common bile duct, and then that goes into the duodenum. So here we got it, right here. So here's the pancreas. Here's the tail of the pancreas. This is kind of underneath the stomach. Here's the head of the pancreas. Here's the pancreatic duct. And then that empties into the common bile duct, which is coming from the liver, and then that goes right into the duodenum right here. And this is where all those stomach acids are neutralized due to that bicarbonate. And so there are generally two kinds of glands. You could classify a gland in the body one of two ways. Anybody remember what maybe are two ways? I can't remember if I've talked about this in class or not. There are two kinds of glands in your body. There are endocrine glands that secrete their product directly into the blood, and another kind of gland secretes something into a duct, which then carries it to where it should go, and that's what we call an exocrine gland. Right? So the pancreas actually has both kind of glands in it. The pancreas has an exocrine division, which secretes bicarbonate, trypsin, amylase, and lipase into the pancreatic duct, which then carries it to the small intestine. That's the exocrine part. And the pancreas also secretes a couple hormones, namely insulin and glucagon, that help regulate blood sugar. I'm not going to talk about that right now. I'm mostly interested in this exocrine part. Okay. That secretes those hormones. I mean, these digestive enzymes. All right. Last thing. One of the last things. The liver. So that's the function of the pancreas, right? It synthesizes and secretes digestive enzymes into the small intestine, but it also helps neutralize acids that are coming from the stomach. Okay, the liver, it forms bile. So the bile is synthesized, no, the liver is synthesizing bile, and it is stored. Where's the gallbladder at? Here it is. Okay, so here is a liver. It's a large organ. It's not the largest organ in your body, but it's very large, maybe the second largest. You can see the right lobe up over here. Here's the wall of your body cavity right here, abdominal cavity. So where's this liver going to be at on you? Yeah, it's going to be on your right side, way over here. And right underneath the liver is the gallbladder right here. So the liver is synthesizing bile all the time, and it's being secreted into a duct. So that's an exocrine function of the liver. And when you're in a fasted state, that means you don't have food in your digestive tract. That bile is stored in the gallbladder. And when you're in a fed state, that means you have material to digest, then the bile leaves the gallbladder, it finds its way to the small intestine. Okay? So here is the gallbladder, and as a matter of fact, here, if we look from underneath the liver, here is the gallbladder right here, underneath the liver. And usually it separates very nicely, right? If you're ever trying to isolate a gallbladder from the liver, it comes apart pretty easy from the liver. Okay, so the ducts that take bile from the liver to the gallbladder are what we call the hepatic ducts. So here's a hepatic duct coming out of the liver. And to get into the gallbladder, it's got to go in the cystic duct. So here's the cystic duct into the gallbladder. That's what happens when you're in a fasted state. And when you're in a fed state, bile leaves the gallbladder via the cystic duct again into the common bile duct. And that common bile duct goes all the way to the small intestine. So those are, that's the duct system that you should be familiar with. Here's another good picture that shows that. Here's the gallbladder. The duct that's going to the gallbladder is called the cystic duct. So here we see the cystic duct right here. The ducts that are coming from, what's this organ right up over here? What's going to be superior to the gallbladder? Yeah, it's the liver, right? So here are ducts coming from the liver. These are what we call the hepatic ducts. You got a right and left hepatic duct that join to form the common hepatic duct. So anytime you hear that hepatic, like hepatitis or hepato, okay, what organ should you think of? Should you think of a bone? You should think of liver, right? It's going to involve the liver. So anytime you hear that hepato, that means liver. So hepatic duct is coming from the liver. And if bile goes into the gallbladder, it goes in via the cystic duct. But if bile goes from the liver to the small intestine. That's going to happen via the common bile duct. So you got hepatic duct, common bile duct, cystic duct. Okay, into the small intestines. And the common bile duct joins the pancreatic duct right here before it enters the small intestine. So you probably should know something about that hepatic duct, where it is, the cystic duct, and common bile duct. Okay, hepatic duct is going to be closest to the liver. So the liver not only secretes bile, oh, but I didn't tell you what bile does. What about if you were to take some oil and put it in a glass of water? What would happen to that oil? Not much, right? It would just kind of sit there. It would just kind of float on the water. It would float right on the water, right? Okay, so when we eat lipids, okay, and what is the solvent that's inside us? Water. So we're going to eat a lipid. How does it dissolve enough so that our body can process it, so it can dissolve it, so it can digest it? It can't digest it if it's a big glob sitting someplace in your body, like your stomach or small intestine. What would you use? Say you had oil all over a glass and you wanted to clean that glass. Could you just rinse it out? No, you'd have to use some kind of soap or detergent that will allow that lipid to dissolve in water. Okay? So your body has to do the same thing. It has to secrete a compound that's very much like a detergent that will allow that lipid to break apart and dissolve into water, and that's what bile does. Okay? Bile emulsifies fats. It means it breaks down big globs of fat into really tiny globs of fat that your body can handle, so that digestive enzymes like lipase can work on these small particles and break them down. The other thing that bile does is that it neutralizes acids. So why is that a good thing? Because where you have a lot of acids in your small intestine? Because your stomach is giving up material to the small intestine, and those stomach contents are very acidic. So bile also helps neutralize those acids that are coming from the stomach. The liver also has some important other functions. It can store certain important elements in your body, like vitamin A, B12, vitamin D, E, and K. These are all fat-soluble vitamins that can be stored in the liver. All right, there's another kind. What's a vitamin here that you don't see? What's a very common vitamin that you might actually take? Somebody said C, vitamin C. Notice that the liver can't store vitamin C because it's water soluble. So that means every time you produce urine, guess what's going to be found in the urine? Vitamin C. And then you void and then you lose that vitamin C. Right? So fat soluble vitamins can be stored in the liver. You don't have to have these every day because you don't lose them every day. Well, the trade-off is because your body can store these vitamins, guess what? They can become toxic because you don't ever lose these vitamins. If you eat too much of them, your liver is going to store way too many, and they can actually produce toxicity. Water-soluble vitamins, because you lose them every day, it's almost impossible to overdose on a water-soluble vitamin. There's some other things that your liver can store, namely iron and copper. What do you need iron for? Yeah, blood, to make competent red blood cells with hemoglobin that can carry oxygen. Okay, but again, you can have too much then of these compounds in your body because the liver can store them. Okay, who do you think is much more sensitive to iron toxicity or iron overload, men or women? Yeah. Men, definitely, right? Because they don't lose iron every month. Okay. Okay. The liver has some other important functions. It can change a form, an inactive form of vitamin D into an active form of vitamin D. And vitamin D is necessary for absorption of calcium from your digestive tract. What's calcium good for? Bones. What else? Muscle contraction. What else? Synaptic transmission. How neurons communicate with each other by releasing neurotransmitter. And calcium is also necessary for blood clotting, so that you can coagulate blood so that you don't bleed to death. So calcium is real important for lots of different things. The liver can convert fat to phospholipids. Where did we ever run into phospholipids? What does a phospholipid make? It makes the cell membrane of every cell in your body is made up of phospholipid, right? So it's a job of the liver to do that. It can also convert amino acids into sugar, They can convert proteins into sugar and also into fat. And your body's metabolism sometimes produces ammonia that's very toxic, and your body can't excrete ammonia because it dissolves everywhere in your body. It's very hard to excrete. So your body converts it to urea, and your kidneys have figured out a way to take urea out of your body and put it in urine so that you can excrete it, so the kidneys can get rid of this toxic ammonia compound. And the liver is also important because it produces clotting factors. We didn't mention much in the way of clotting factors. Okay, but it needs vitamin K to make those clotting factors. Okay, so I think that's pretty much it for the digestive system. And I don't know if I gave you this or not, but I'm not going to cover this. Okay, I think this is probably, everybody knows this now. A lot of times when you get a blood test, they measure different kinds of lipids that you have in your blood. There are triglycerides and LDLs and HDLs. And basically, LDLs and HDLs have to do with cholesterol, how cholesterol is being handled in your body. And the HDLs carry cholesterol from the tissues to the liver to be removed from the body. LDLs carry cholesterol to the tissues. LDLs produce a lot of pathology. The HDLs are protective. They protect your cardiovascular system. So your HDL level should be high. Your LDL level should be low. But I'm not going to test you on that. That's just some basic information. Okay, what about, we've got 10 minutes to go over the questions over here. Okay, but who's got a question? Anybody have a question? Okay. Know the structures which make up the elementary canal. You got mouth. The next would be your throat, like pharynx, esophagus, stomach. What are the three parts of the small intestine? Starting with the most proximal one. Duodenum, jejunum, ileum. That's all the parts of the small intestine. And then after the small... Oh, no, I got to go over something else. Large intestine. It's an exam figure. Holy cow. Okay. Then large intestine. And then kind of out of your body. Ah, here's the exam figure. Oh, yeah. We got to go over this. Sorry about that. All right, so what are the parts of the small intestine again? You got the duodenum, jejunum, and ileum. And the ileum then is going to empty into the large intestine. Ah, sorry about it. I forgot the large intestine. So here is the ileum right here that empties into the large intestine. But there's a gate right here as well. There's a sphincter, circular smooth muscle right here. And we call that the ileocecal sphincter because this part of the large intestine is called the cecum. So ileocecal sphincter right here. That helps control material leaving the small intestine going into the large intestine. Okay. Well, the major parts of the large intestine, what side is your appendix on? The right side. So here is your liver up over here, and then here is the appendix. All right, so a lot of times that can get inflamed and cause a lot of pain. Sometimes it's got to be removed if it's going to explode. All right, and so that's the appendix. That's a lymphoid tissue. Cecum. The next part is the ascending colon. And then the large intestine goes over to the other side of the body via the transverse section. Okay, but you don't want fecal material up over there. You want it outside your body. So then there's got to be a descending part over here. And then there's a couple curved sections. Right, this is what we call the sigmoid colon. And then the sigmoid colon empties into the rectum and then the anal canal out of your body. You see some other kinds of structures. You see a lot of blood vessels in the mesentery that supply the large intestine with blood. And you see these pockets. These are what we call haustra. These pockets right here for absorbing water. And then there's this longitudinal muscle stripe right here. That's what we call the tinea coli. That helps in peristalsis and moving fecal material through the large intestine. And the large intestine has all the layers, like any other part of the digestive tract, like the serosa, the muscularis layer, the submucosa and mucosa. And, okay, I think that's pretty much about it for the large intestine. Other classes, when you get into anatomy, you're going to learn a lot more about the large intestine. But we're not going to talk about the questions today. We'll start with that next time, unless I can do a couple. But the large intestine, depending on family history, depending on your genetic makeup, is prone to form cancers, colon cancer, right, which is a very prevalent cancer. I think probably about 50,000 people in the United States alone die of colon cancer every year. That's a huge number. And that's kind of sad because colon cancer is one of the kinds of cancers that is completely curable. So what's your choice? Being cured or dying of cancer? Yeah, it'd be a lot much better to be cured all the time. So how do you find out if you have colon cancer? All right, well, with all cancers, it's very important that you get diagnosed early. If you get diagnosed late, for instance, when you have rectal bleeding, that's a late case of colon cancer, there's almost nothing that we can do for anybody at that stage. But that's when it becomes obvious. So how do you protect yourself from being one of those 50,000 people? And you get an investigation of your large intestine. It's either a sigmoidoscopy, which investigates what? This first initial segment of the large intestine, or a colonoscopy, which investigates this whole descending part of the colon as well as the sigmoid right here. Okay, so everybody in here should do that for sure by age 30, and especially by, if you have family history of colon cancer, probably age 20, and repeat it every so often. And it's not a particularly bad exam, but there's a couple little problems with it, and that is that you have to remove all of the fecal material from the large intestine so that when somebody investigates with a light tube and a camera, they can see what they're looking at in here. All right. So one of the ways that you cleanse the colon is by drinking a solution that gives you, what, copious watery diarrhea. But, of course, that's exactly what you want, because when somebody investigates in here, you don't want to have to repeat the exam because you didn't clean the intestine out properly, right? So the important thing about this exam is to take the preparation very seriously. And does anybody know what the name of that preparation is? It's kind of a cruel name. It's called Go Lightly. But you don't go lightly when you take it, okay? But it's important for you to follow the instructions exactly so that when you get that investigation, they can see if there's any kinds of nodules or nodes or polyps that are starting to grow. And if there's a polyp there, they remove it. A polyp is not cancerous, but if you leave it grow for 5 or 10 years, then it can become cancerous. So you've got like decades to take care of this problem. So it's really a shame that actually people die of colon cancer when that happens. All right, so you got a choice. You can do a sigmoidoscopy or you can do a colonoscopy. Which one do you think is better? Okay, the sigmoidoscopy is easier. The colonoscopy takes a little bit longer. All right, but which one is better? If you were going to choose one or the other, what would you do? What's the difficult part of all this? Is the preparation, right? Taking that go lightly material, right? So if you're going to go through that whole preparation, I certainly recommend getting a colonoscopy, not just a sigmoidoscopy, because a lot of times when they do a sigmoidoscopy, they say, oh, well, we found something and we're really curious. Guess what we need to do? We need to do a colonoscopy, right? So then what do you say? I mean, I got to go through the preparation again? And they say, well, yeah, wasn't it fun? And you'll say, well, no, it wasn't really particularly fun. So if you have a choice, just go for the colonoscopy the first time and get it over with, right? And the other thing is, too, and a lot of places don't like to do this, is that there's probably no reason in the world why you should be conscious while they're doing that exam. Right? Unless you're really interested in what the inside of your intestine looks like. But you know what? They can film it for you and put it on a videotape or a CD if you're really interested. Okay, so always ask for anesthesia. Right? Because sometimes, guess what happens? We learned this today. What happens if you stretch a part of your intestine? What does it do? How does it respond? It contracts because of the myenteric plexus. So if somebody's goofing around in here, right, with a light tube and a camera, guess what's going to happen to that small intestine or large intestine? It's going to constrict, it's going to cramp, and if you're conscious, you're going to feel pain. Okay? So there's no reason why you should necessarily feel that, but you might have to assert yourself and say, yeah, give me anesthetic And they have some wonderful anesthetics for this procedure. Very short acting, which means that the onset is very fast. They'll hook up an IV and they'll say, okay, count down from 10 to 1. And you go 10, 9, all right? And then something funny, you kind of like cough or something, and then you'll start counting 7, 6. And there'll be a nurse trying to wake you up saying, well, the exam is over. Okay, so it's actually wonderful anesthesia, but you probably shouldn't drive. Even though you recover very fast, you probably shouldn't drive home by yourself. So you have to bring somebody with you to do that colonoscopy. So that's typically why they don't do it at a doctor's office, right? But you can ask and say, well, I'll provide a driver, right? There usually aren't many complications.
I went yesterday with my dad for the consultation.
Uh-huh. Okay, I would do a little surgery center. Probably don't need a whole hospital. Yeah, but I've known a lot of women to die of it too. Yeah, but it's certainly more prevalent in women than, say, breast cancer in men. Men can get breast cancer, but it's relatively rare. Yeah. Okay, that's it for today. So don't forget, what do you got next time? Quiz on digestive system. Hi. Huh?
A test isn't in there.
Oh.
Right now to go to make sure.
Okay.
He's like, no.
Okay.
There's someone for another student, so I don't know. If
no, maybe I just forgot to take
okay.
it over there.
So okay. We're
I'll do it right now. How's right now?
Okay.
And if you want to take it today, that's fine.
Yeah, I want to right now.
Okay. Good. I'll take it over right now. So if you would just want to follow me around,
sure.
Make sure I do it so
okay.
I don't get sidetracked by some other.
Did you bring anything on the top floor of 16 and 17?
No.
Even
I got an old one. I have an old one.
Oh, maybe it's a dentist.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
But I'll try to remember to print out the figures and everything.
Figure too.
Yeah. Thank you.
The whole computer back 14 is doing the same thing. Like when it's
60. Oh, really?
Yeah, it's gonna log in again.
Let's see if we can change it real quick back. Did I drop you?
I'm not sure.
That's the only other reason maybe why you can't get in. I don't think I did.
I don't know, because I don't know.
Did you miss two tests or anything? That's the only reason why I would drop somebody.
No, oh, test?
Yeah, test. You never missed one. Okay. Okay.